So if we could give Jeff W. a big warm welcome from the Valley Group, it would be very appreciated.
Well, thank you, Jim, very much. It was nice talking to you this morning. I was on my bike riding, so it taught me a good time, my meditation time. As it's already been said, my sobriety date is June 25th, 1990. I actually only drank 12 years from 13 to 25. But during that short time, I created a lot of wreckage. I feel like I was an alcoholic waiting to happen, and I'll obviously get more into that. I didn't lose anything like you hear on the country song. I didn't lose anything, because at 25 I hadn't acquired anything. So can't speak about that. I did grow up in Fresno. I lived in Clovis the last 25 years. I would say I had a good childhood with lots of friends, played some sports. I got good grades up until junior high. I would say things were pretty normal. And then in junior high, it was kind of like a crossroads. I could go two ways. I could become a prep or a stoner. And I'm not sure if everybody knows those terms, but I chose to become a stoner with long hair, bell bottoms, and steel-toed boots. And I did that for a couple of years. I also came from a household that drank. The parents drank every day, regularly. We had pictures of them at parties, having fun. So we associated drinking with the good life. There was wine underneath the kitchen sink. There was liquor bottles in the cupboard, beer in the fridge sometimes. We'd also find bottles of gin in the couch in our bedroom. You couldn't go 2, 3, 5 feet without finding a bottle of dad's gin somewhere. And I remember about 8 or 9, I'd wake up in the morning and on my dresser would be a glass of gin, almost fully drank. And sometimes I would see him sitting in our room watching us. Me and my brother who's on here, we would be sleeping and he'd be watching us sleep and drinking gin. So super creepy. Nothing else happened, but that was pretty weird. And then I would say for the first sip of beer or alcohol I had was at the age of 12. We went with our parents to Santa Cruz and they had some friends there and we went to the wharf and bought some salmon and took it back to their house and they had a beautiful patio. It was a nice sunny day and we barbecued the fish. It was really good. Dad said, offered a sip of his Olympia beer, which again is that's not sold too much lately, but I remember that. And it was a nice day. Just had a sip, didn't want any more, wasn't craving it. Tasted bitter, really thought nothing more about it, didn't think it was a big deal. The next time I remember drinking was about the age of 13, and I had some blackberry brandy, and it was a cold night, and it tasted warm, and it tasted good, and it went down a little bit strong, but I liked it. And by then, I wanted more. It made me feel good. I didn't get drunk, but it was on from that point. Also in junior high, there was a lot of peer pressure to get high and smoke weed, and that was the late 70s. So the stuff they had back then was nothing like what they have today. I didn't really care for it. It wasn't my thing. It kind of made me paranoid. So I didn't do it too much. My first job was mowing lawns. We pushed a mower around the neighborhood. And to reward ourselves, we would go up to the Goodwill, thrift center. And there was a guy that worked there, and we would get beer from him. He'd go buy us a quart of Miller High Life, and we would drink that because we had worked hard mowing lawns. And already, was the concept of work hard, play hard. And that will continue for a long time. Also, they had dances, junior high dances, and I wasn't super confident at that point, but we would get like a half pint of Seagram's or something, and by the time we got to the dance, I was Rico Suave and super smooth and could talk to all the girls, and, you know, it was great. It worked at that time. It worked for me. Fast forward to 15, I started drinking every weekend. So now we're drinking beer every weekend. We're playing quarters and caps, if anybody remembers those games. And I never won. I was kind of a lightweight. I couldn't hang, as they say. And that's when I started passing out and blacking out a lot. Our dad took us to get our license on our 16th birthday. He pulled us out of school to do that. I don't know why. Wrecked a lot of cars. Shouldn't have got my license until I was 25. In fact, when I was 17, I wasn't drinking, but I took my parents' car over by my brother's girlfriend's house for whatever reason, and slid around the corner and crashed into her tree in the front yard, and more or less kind of totaled the car. And of course, my dad got there and he was pissed, and Brian wasn't too happy because I'm in front of his girlfriend's house, and that's not a cool thing to do when you're in high school. So just a lot of, you know, wreckage starting to happen. Another time I took my girlfriend down, if anybody knows, by Fresno State. It's a 15-mile-an-hour zone, Fresno State College, and there's a police force that works for the college right there. And I was doing 85 down there on the way to the movies in a 15 zone and drunk. I had a bottle of Seagram 7 with me, and, you know, I was 17. I had a 15-year-old girl with me. I was in her parents' car, which is, they love me, which that's another whole other story. But for whatever reason, they got called to something else. That should have been my first DUI, and all I got was a speeding ticket. I got lucky at 15. I guess I did, or maybe I didn't. I don't know. You know, another time I fast forward about 17, that I would say that was the heaviest I drank was at 17. I had a friend down the street and we pulled a runner and got 4 12 packs of beer at 7-Eleven. I refused to split it with him, so he threw my keys out of the car. I could not find him, so we got in a fist fight in the front of my girlfriend's house. I think it was a tie, I'm not sure, but we were both pretty beat up. And the next morning, I can remember at 17 just crying to my mom that I was just so depressed and confused and angry, and I didn't like who I was. I didn't like my friends. I just didn't like, you know, where I was going. And the police called us, and we had to go back and pay for the beer. So we didn't go to jail, but we had to go to 7-Eleven and make that right, which we did. Another time we were coming home from a concert, and a buddy of mine stole the M off of McDonald's over on Cedar and Herndon. And that thing is bigger than you think. It's like 5 by 5 feet. And we ended up driving about 100 miles an hour down Cedar Avenue being chased by the security cop from McDonald's. And he didn't catch us. But again, the next day we got a call by the police that we had to go back. And we had to go to the hardware store and get a ton of different glues until we could glue that thing back onto the wall. So again, just some more wreckage. You know, and then the fights. You know, I was very angry. I didn't like myself. I'd drive my car 100 miles an hour and probably had a death wish doing that. But I come home and challenge my dad to a fight. And it was like a battle royale, because usually it was like my brother and my dad against me, just trying to keep me down. And then one time, I went to hit, my brother went to hit me, and he hit my mom instead, and she had a black eye. But then, you know, a lot of other times, you know, I'd wake up and I had no memory of the night before. I had passed out, blacked out, and wake up the next morning and, you know, mom's got a black eye and crying, and I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't quit. They ended up getting, sending me to a psychiatrist like the last year of school, and I was on their insurance. I think that kept me sane. And then after that, I started going myself, to him. And he would tell me, he would talk about the cause and effect of drinking, that he would point out to me that when I drank, bad things happened. And maybe if I didn't drink, those bad things wouldn't happen. And I listened to him, and that made a lot of sense. But I didn't stop doing it. I just kept doing it because I couldn't stop. I about that time I'd punch holes in the wall at home and rip off the rotary phone that was on the wall so many times. I became an expert on drywall because I'd fix it. Another time my dad handcuffed me, and he got a wooden cane, and it had little knurls on it, little sharp pieces on it, and he hit me over the face with it and really needed stitches, but I just went to 7-Eleven and got some Band-Aids and fixed it that way. But my brother had come there to 7-Eleven and said, "Hey, you can't go home, man." And I'm like, "Why?" He goes, "Dad's in the front room with the lights off waiting for you." And I'm like, "To do what?" You know, and we didn't know. So I can't remember where I stayed that night, but it was pretty bad. Brian's on this call, and I hope he won't mind, but he got into it too. Dad took a bath to the back of his head one night because he got into it a little bit, got a little mouthy. And it was just regular that either the cops would come or there's helicopters, and, you know, this is a middle class neighborhood and, very quiet. And, you know, one night my dad thought he was drunk and smoking in his bed, and I get up at 2 a.m. and everybody out of the house, and he's pushing his mattress out the front door on fire. It's funny now, but when you look back, it's like you're a young kid and like, what the hell is going on? And, nothing to see here. Just go back to bed. It's all good. Another night I grabbed a knife and I started to go after somebody in the house with it. And then I put it up to my throat, and the cops were there in our front room, and my brother had got in between me and the cops. And that cop said, "If you don't drop that knife, we're going to shoot you." And thank God my brother was there because he saved my life. So appreciate that. 17, 18, I was a real loner in high school. In senior year, I just wasn't popular. I fixed my schedule so I could get out at noon, and then I don't know how I did it, but I'd start drinking at noon. So I'd had a 12 pack on the seat of my car. I'd use it as an armrest and, you know, just drive around all day and doing nothing and just really wasting time. I had a janitor job cleaning offices at night, and I would get drunk at work, and the other guys would find me and like ask me, why are you drinking at work? And it's like, why wouldn't I? It's normal. It's what we do. We drink, you know? I mean, I didn't understand that you couldn't drink at work, and ended up getting fired from that job. So things got bad when I turned, when I graduated from high school. I got my first DUI, 1983, paid the fine, had a restricted license, but didn't know jail time. When I was in jail, I was very belligerent. I remember I said, "Hey, give me my call. I want to make my call." And they weren't letting me. And then I looked over and saw a guy that, had been mouthy like me, and four of the sheriffs took him down and took his boots off and looked at me and said, "You want some of that?" And I said, "No, I'm good." And so I was quiet after that. But I didn't stop drinking. In fact, I started doing heavier drugs. You know, still passing out, still blacking out, you know, but doing drugs as well. And then one night I was down Clovis Avenue, and in a blackout, I slammed into a Suburban and totaled my car, messed their car up a little bit. I don't think anybody was hurt, but I got the second DUI within 6 months when I was 18, and with a hit and run. And I got a lawyer, and again, I was still going to that psychiatrist, and I was super scared of going to jail, and I'm not the type of person that, you know, would do well in jail, I don't think, and I was really worried about it. I had him write me a letter. I ended up doing about 9 days of community service. I did the DUI school. Back then it was called 5x5 down in Divisadero. But even then, if they tested you when you were in that school, you would go to jail. You would just, you know, your probation, you would shine all that, and you just do your time. And we drank the whole time through. I'd go to bars at 18 with guys, you know, that were going there to that class with me. And then I'd drink and do drugs all night and come to the meeting the next night, and they're like, "What are you doing, man? You're going to get in trouble." And I just, again, I couldn't stop. It was interesting. My dad was giving me a ride down there, but about halfway through it, he stopped doing that. I had to get my own ride or walk or take the bus and figure it out. And he should have. That was the right thing for him to do. But during that time, that's when I started going to AA meetings. I was court ordered, and so I remember going to the first meeting was Northeast Fellowship, and it was on Blackbeard's in Clovis. Blackbeard's the, you know, the fun place. And I remember a couple things. One, that there was no way these people were sober. There was no way, because I just couldn't imagine life without it. And I thought, no, you know what? They come to this meeting, and then they go have one or two drinks, and they learn how to control it. And the other thing I thought was that they were all a bunch of whiners. They were all complaining. And when each of them talked about their whatever issue they had, I would fix their problems in my mind. And then by the time I left, I'm like, okay, I'm good. I took care of all that. Now we're going to go play cards and drink beer or whatever. So, and then it got to the point where I just quit going to the meetings, and I'd have the guys at the poker party we were at sign their names on the court cards, which I don't recommend, and don't do that. But again, I really wasn't ready at that time. During that time, I did read, you know, a lot of the books, you know, the Living Sober, the 12x12, the Big Book, and they did have an effect on me. So I think at that, during that time, the seed was sown. I had like 1 foot in that world and 1 foot in the old world. So I know a lot of people now that when they come to the meetings and they go back out, I always think, well, you know, at least the seed is sown and they know where to come back to. And so truly that got me started. At 21 years old, I started to do more drugs. And what that did for me is I was able to drink and not pass out or black out. So I would do just enough drugs. I was like a chemist. I would do just enough drugs to allow me to drink and not pass out. And I would stay out only once where I stayed up for 2 days or something, and I didn't like it. At 23, I worked at a restaurant, because I always worked at a restaurant because you could drink and do drugs there. And it was New Year's Eve one night, and we're course, we had fun at work. On the way home down Shaw Avenue, I was buzzed, and there was a sobriety checkpoint. And I go, well, this is it. I'm going to get pulled over, and this is number three, and I'm screwed. And sure enough, I got waved by. And I don't know what you call that, but that technically would at least be number four right there. So, you know, at this point, I'm a loner. You know, I'm 24 now, and I'm home. I'm drinking at home a lot. Got a, you know, world's pretty small. I did have a job at a restaurant, different restaurant. I wouldn't eat all day. I'd get off at 5, I'd drink beers, have a couple kamikazes, grab a pint of vodka on the way home, or go by my parents' house and make mixed drinks with them, which is very sick behavior. And then I'd go home and pass out. One time, we lived upstairs. I had a roommate, and I woke up one morning after, you know, being passed out, and he said, "Hey, you know what you did last night?" I said, "No." And he goes, "Oh, you went down and argued with the neighbors, and you were naked." And I believed him. He had me going for quite a while, but, you know, I'd leave the stove on, and I'd leave the front door open. I got nose broken a couple times, got in a lot of fights over girls. Just not good. So kind of what got me sober at 25 is I was very... Towards the end there, I was very sick with bronchitis for like a year, and I couldn't get rid of it. And I had insurance through my job, so I went to the doctor, and he gave me some free antibiotics, and I got off the... I got cured, you know, fixed. The bronchitis went away. And he also said I had high cholesterol, and I had a fatty liver, is what he called it. And so he asked me how much I drank, and I said, you know, I told him I was honest. And he said, "Well, you know, I think you may be an alcoholic." And he said, I can't help you, but I know people that can. And I just referred somebody to an outpatient program, Advanced Recovery Services. And he said, and his thoughts about alcoholics were, if he had his way, he would put them all in Alcoholic City, which at the time was kind of a slam and, you know, not a cool thing, but I was so down at that point. I didn't really care. I was listening. I wanted something better. And I had, at that point, I had no legal issues. I had nobody, no heat to make this change. But I was truly sick and tired. I was done. I was spiritually, physically tired. And so I called ARS and met with Mary and Barry, the directors. They were both recovering alcoholics, and went over there and at 9 in the morning, and they asked me if I want a cup of coffee, and I said, "Why?" And they said, "Because you look like you could use one," because I was pale and I was sick. And so he asked me, "Hey, what do you want to get out of this?" And I said, "You know, I want peace of mind. I want the voices to stop. I just want peace of mind." He said, you will get that." And I believed in him. And right then I had hope, and it was like a huge weight was lifted off my shoulders. I was finally calm for once. I had 100% faith that if I did this, I would get better and my life would get better. And I kind of had a vision of what my life could be at that point. It was 8 weeks with 4 months of aftercare. So we'd go 4 nights a week, 3 hours a night, and then 3 AA meetings on the weekend. And then there was 4 months of aftercare meeting once a month. It was $18.50, which back then was a lot of money. And I didn't have the money when I signed up. And he said, "Well, let's just sign up and see how it goes." And so I did, and the insurance took care of all the $300. It was kind of a God thing, I felt. A God thing that I had a job that had insurance available. And I was a cook, making $8 an hour back then. But yet I had very good insurance. And so did that. And during that time, we had to work the first three steps. And we used the 12x12. And I had to, on the first step, I had to get up and give a presentation. And you were, you know, if you didn't do it right, you had to do it again. And I did mine right. And then, you know, work step two and work step three. And then we had to get a temporary sponsor before we could leave the program, which is typical of most programs. And I picked a guy that was, you know, they say, look for somebody that's like you. So this guy had, you know, he was full of tattoos, you know, very much older than me. But, and when I asked him, will you be my temporary sponsor? He said, I'll let you know. And that was really hard because, A, it's hard to ask somebody to be your sponsor. And then for them to say, I'll let you know, that's even worse. But he did become my sponsor. And I did work the steps with him. I worked the fourth step with him. And, you know, when I did that, it was like another big weight was lifted because I thought I was unique. I thought I had done things that, you know, that were so bad that I won't mention here. But he had done a lot of the same things and worse. So that was comforting to know that here was a guy that had done what I'd done. And now he's successful, he has his own business, he's doing well, he's sober, he's happy, right? So, you know, kind of the idea, if he could do it, I could do it. You know, and for me, the God thing really in the beginning was, you know, working the first three steps. We talk about, you know, God and turning our life over, and it was really the group, you know, a group of drunks or good orderly direction, because we never went to church. We weren't raised that way. So for me, it was really the people I went through that program with. There's about 10 of us, and also the directors, and listening to them and doing what I was told. And then, you know, later on it became, you know, more than that. But in the beginning, it was good orderly direction. One thing I remember there, we had a feelings chart, and like a 5-year-old, you had to express how you felt, and you know we couldn't numb out anymore because that's why we drank and everything, and so that we could just numb out and not feel. And so we had to learn new ways to deal with our emotions. Before it was feel, drink, behave. You know, so like I feel mad, get drunk, and I behave badly. Now it would be think, feel, behave. So we learned to think differently about things so we felt better and then acted in a godly manner. Through the AA program, I learned a better way of life, a design for living. I started to grow up and be more mature. I also learned about the disease of the program. So I learned that there was something called a Jelinek cycle, and basically it takes a person from a casual drinker to a, you know, oblivion, right? And, you know, along the way is, you know, passing out, blacking out, different stages. And at 25, I was almost towards the end of somebody drinking. I'd shown a lot of those signs, and that scared the hell out of me. Along with that fatty liver issue, I thought, okay, well, if I keep drinking, I'm going to die. And, the other piece was, you know, so for me, the first miracle in sobriety was the compulsion to drink was lifted early on. So I remember in the first couple weeks, I would go like to an AM, PM or whatever and walk in and not want to be pulled over to the cooler and take home a 12-pack. And so that stuck with me the whole time. That's not to say that on occasion I'll have a 5 or 10 second thought about a cold beer on a hot day, but I'm able to think that through and think it all the way through and, you know, where's that? I'm going to end up with, you know, cocaine, hookers and crash cars and whatever. It's not going to be good. So, thank God that I was able to have that removed early. You know, part of my sobriety, or, you know, what keeps me sober is being in service. And so I took on doing a newsletter after I got out of that ARS, advanced recovery. And I did that for about a year, and it kept me in contact with my the people I had gone through that group with, and it kept me in service, and it helped me stay sober. But for the first time in my life, I could concentrate too, and I listened. I could quiet my mind enough that I could listen and read. And I started to read all the books, the 12 by 12, the big book, the 24 hours a day, as Bill sees it, one day at a time. Back then, there was a lot of cassette tapes that you would listen to, go to speaker meetings. I prayed for God to keep me sober and direct my day in the morning, thanked him at night. And I was super disciplined with that. I would get on my knees morning and night. I did the St. Francis prayer. I really liked that one. Paying attention to the part about understand versus being understood. My roommate that I lived with, that I'd grown up with, he got sober. I'm not sure if it's because of me, but he got sober. We started working on the mind, body, and the spirit, you know, the whole part of it, working out, eating right. I was in really good shape at that time. I went to Al-Anon. I went to Adult Children of Alcoholics. I even went to some group therapy with my aunt, which was kind of weird. Read books on codependency. And then doing the four step, I realized, I had resentments against my parents. So, you know, when I did the amends with my mom and dad, I was able to, apologize for the stuff I did, and they were just very thankful that I had turned my life around and super happy about, very supportive. And then I was able to understand, why they were the way they were, and forgive them for things that I felt they wronged me on. But what it also did was it made me look at myself. So even today, working the program today, whenever there's a problem, I have to look at me first. It's one finger pointed at that way and three back at me. So whenever I don't like something in somebody, it's because I'm doing it too, and I know that. My brother's on here, but we were like little hellions as kids, and we were ADD and on Ritalin, and my mom would smoke a whole pack of cigarettes in one car ride. It was crazy. She died in 2011, and I was glad I could be one of her caregivers. She did finally say she was sorry to me because she had never done that in her whole life. So that's something I'll always treasure. As life moved on, I got married. I had a daughter with my wife, and I had a daughter from a previous relationship, and she had two daughters. So life got real busy. We started going to church, and I quit going to meetings for a long time. And my brother would tell me, "Hey, what are you doing to stay sober?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm going to church, right?" And he knew that, because he had gotten sober 6 years after I did, and so he knew that it wasn't enough, and he invited me to it was 12 guys working the 12 steps, and part of that meeting was getting that each guy would get a sponsee to come to the meeting. And so after 20 years in, and I'd never sponsored anybody, I got a second new sponsor, and I started sponsoring people, which helped me. And also, Brian was in the GSO, the General Service stuff. He was a GSR, DSM, a lot of different service positions within the AA, service structure. And I was jealous, and so being competitive, I too, got involved with a lot of things, PICPC, H&I, a lot of different things, and I don't say that to brag, I just say that, it takes what it takes, and there is nothing else, nothing that brings me more peace of mind than when I'm in service and helping somebody else, because I'm out of my head. We used to go speak at high schools and Fresno State, and I spoke at Fresno State with some younger kids there, and it was a health class, and I told him I drank to quiet the voices in my head. And at the end of the talk, one of them asked me a question. Hey, tell me more about those voices. And I said, look, it's not like there's some voice telling me to go to Walmart and kill everybody wearing a green shirt. It was more about self-loathing and just hating myself and just analyzing every situation and just madness, insanity, right? And again, back to the peace of mind. And I can't say I'm a spiritual guru today, and probably won't quote much of the big book to you, but I try to live the program today, and I try to use it, and it's almost automatic now. When I go throughout my day, I pray. When I'm upset, I don't react the way I used to. For me, it's all about just growing up and being a mature adult, not causing wreckage, helping others, being of service. I can't say enough for, some of the guys that we, there's a pretty close group that we have of guys that meet Wednesday night, and we meet outside of that for UFC fights and everything. And, what a blessing that is to have a solid group of friends. And I just can't recommend that more. That early on to get into the pack, get into the herd, and you won't get picked off. Don't stick around the edges. Get involved. Get out of your comfort zone. Take a chance. When I took a chance on sobriety, I was scared and I was excited at the same time. Right now I'm looking to change careers, and it's the same feeling. I'm scared of the unknown, but I'm excited of the possibilities. But I do have faith that God is leading me in the right direction. I'm doing the next dedicated thing, which I was told early on to do. You just do the next dedicated thing, and I'm going where it's leading me. So, if you're new to AA, I will tell you what a gal named Marjé told me 30 years ago. She was an older gal that smoked. She had a raspy voice, and she said, "Don't drink even if your ass falls off." And I never knew what that meant. And then she would say, "Stick around till the miracle happens." And I did know what that meant. And that's happened, more times than I can think of. Also, get a sponsor. Find someone you can relate to. Get into service right away. Guys that I sponsor, I get them into service right away, and it helps tremendously. And just enjoy the ride. And, help others. Thank you for letting me speak.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Can we have a round of